This morning we're going to be looking at the Old Testament book of Esther, the story of Esther. It's a story that is told in 10 chapters. It's one of two books in the Bible that are actually named after women in the Bible, and the other one being the book of Ruth. Now this is a fast-moving, action-packed story. It's a story of romance. It's a story of attempted murder and genocide, a story of deception and corrupt political power. So there's plenty for us to get into and to understand about this book. Now, we're not going to be reading all 10 chapters of the book of Esther this morning, you're probably quite pleased to hear, but we are going to read just a few verses from the opening chapters from Esther chapter 1 and chapter 2. If you're following in the church Bibles, it's on page 354, and we're going to be reading from Esther chapter 1, beginning at the first verse. Seemed like a good place to start. And then reading a few verses into chapter 2. But I won't be reading all the verses, just a few extracts from Esther chapter 1 and Esther chapter 2. So verse 1 then. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia, Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. And then going to verse 10 of chapter 1. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. Moving to verse 19. This was their response. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Then into chapter 2, verse 1. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. And then verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. The book of Esther is found within the five scrolls, or the Megaloth, as it's also known. These are five books, or five scrolls, include the books of Ruth, the Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, and the book of Esther that we've just read a little bit from. And the idea is that these books are read during the Jewish festivals as they are celebrated, and they would read through these books in the tabernacle. Now, the book of Esther is rather unusual, and it's something that we're going to have to come to get get to grips with as we look at this book, in that there's actually no mention of God's name at all anywhere in the 10 chapters of the book of Esther. There's not even any direct reference to worship or to prayer. But this is not some sort of secular novel. It's intended to demonstrate God's provision and God's guidance for his people, his protection for them during very difficult times that they found themselves in at that time. And this is a story that even today is celebrated widely by the Jewish people, as I say, at the festival of Purim. Now, the historical background to this story is that right back in 587 BC, I need to sort of set the context a little bit for you so that it makes sense, the story of Esther. But back in 587 BC, the Babylonian army, who was led at the time by a very young King Nebuchadnezzar, he stormed into Jerusalem, he broke down the walls, he smashed down the temple, and he ransacked the city. And then he dragged the people away off to Babylon into exile at that time. And this is when we read in the Bible of the accounts of the likes of Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then the Babylonian Empire then was superseded by the Persian Empire. And we read of King Cyrus, who was the king of Persia at the time, and he allowed the rebuilding of the temple back in Jerusalem. And there was a remnant of the Israelites, about 50,000 of them, who returned to Israel at that time to rebuild the temple and try to rebuild Jerusalem and put things back together again. As I said, it's about 50,000 of the Jewish people at that time who returned. And this is when we read of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah and also Ezra at the time. And we've been thinking about the prophet Haggai, haven't we, over the last few weeks here at Wantage Baptist Church, and how Haggai challenged the people to make the rebuilding of God's temple their priority. And the book of Esther is not actually set in Judah or in Israel, but it's actually set right back in Persia. So these were the Israelites who didn't go back to Jerusalem. These are the Jewish people who stayed in the land of Persia in exile. And the story takes place in the king of King Xerxes of Persia. It's about 480 BC. And it takes place in Susa. And Susa is about 150 miles east of the capital Babylon at the time, in modern-day Iran. And Susa was the winter residence for the Persian king. So they spent a lot of time in Susa when they weren't in Babylon. And this story, as I say, is set in Susa. And the main storyline in the book of Esther is about a plot to kill and to destroy the Jewish people who were in Persia at the time. But God orchestrates things. God changes things. God ensures the preservation and the safety of his people so that they were not destroyed. And that's really what this story is about. And the heroes of this story are Esther and also Mordecai. Esther was this beautiful and courageous young Jewish woman. She lived in Persia with her uncle, Mordecai. There's some dispute whether it's her real uncle or some relation within the family. So it's not very clear what the relationship was. But certainly Mordecai was a relative of hers. And she was an only child. She was an orphan. Her mum and dad had died. And Mordecai had brought her up as if she was his only daughter. And Mordecai, we read, was a palace official. That's what he did in his job. Now, very recently, here in the UK, bringing us up to modern times, we've had this excitement, haven't we, of a royal wedding. And I'm sure many of you will have watched on the television the marriage of Prince Harry to the American Meghan Markle. And in the opening chapters of Esther in chapters 1 and 2, we have another royal wedding. We've just been reading about that. We read how King Xerxes of Persia, he held a luxurious banquet, and he got all the nobles and all the big people in the land and dignitaries, and he invited them to this luxurious banquet, and he summons Queen Vashti to attend. But the queen refuses to attend. And King Xerxes, he gets mad. He gets really angry at this. And he's had enough. So he decides that he's going to depose and get rid of his wife. He thinks enough is enough. Later on in the story, we read how the king then decides that he wants a new wife, having deposed and got rid of his old wife. So he decides to hold a beauty contest. And he commands that all of the young, beautiful ladies in the land, all the virgins in the land, that they should attend, and that from those he would then choose a replacement wife. And Mordecai enters his niece Esther into this beauty contest. And when King Xerxes sees Esther, he knows that she is the one for him. He is smitten by her. And he places a crown on her head, and he makes her queen instead of Vashti. But under very strict instructions from Mordecai, Esther does not reveal to the king at that time that she actually is a Jew, that she's of that Jewish descendancy, that she wasn't actually a true Persian. And this is important as we come to the story later on. Now Mordecai then discovers a conspiracy to kill the king, to assassinate the king. And he tells Queen Esther, and Queen Esther then tells the king. And the king obviously sends his soldiers and other people to find out who these traitors are, and he kills them. Now you might think that that romantic rags-to-riches story might be where we might finish here in Esther. And this then coupled with this failed assassination attempt, it seems pretty much that everything's ready now and in place for a happy ever ending story. But no, there's much more to come, much, much more. And the story very dramatically continues. We're then introduced to the villain of the piece, Haman. He then enters the story. Now, Haman became the main advisor to the king, the second in command in the land. And basically, Haman is arrogant, Haman is proud, and Haman makes sure that when everyone else is around, he wants all the people to bow down before him. And everybody does, except Mordecai. So Haman gets to hate Mordecai because of his lack of appreciation, and it doesn't appeal to his pride to have this one man who refuses to bow to him. And Haman hated him so much that he decided that he was going to get rid of Mordecai, and not only Mordecai, but all of his people as well. And Haman persuades the king to sign a death warrant to let him exterminate, to massacre the people, the Jewish people, in that land. And Haman is often regarded as the Old Testament equivalent of Adolf Hitler, because his plans involve that ethnic cleansing, that extermination, that annihilation of the Jewish people at the time. And we read that Haman drew lots to choose the day on which he was going to massacre the people, when he was going to kill them all. And he also built this huge scaffold on which he planned to hang Mordecai and to kill him and to make a public example of him. A desperate time for the Jewish people in Persia as they face death, as they face destruction, as they face extinction as a people. And Mordecai lets Queen Esther know what's going on with her people. He reminds her that she also is a Jew. He reminds her that she also should be put to death under this death penalty. He reminds her that she has been placed in this position of authority as the queen for such a time as this. This was now her time to use her influence. And they come up with a cunning plan together. But first, the Jewish people at that time, including Mordecai and Esther, they fast before they take any action. 3 days later, Esther is very courageous as she enters the king's presence. Usually this would mean a death penalty for anybody coming unannounced before the king. This was not allowed. The king wanted his privacy. He wanted to do things his way. Just to come into the king's presence, even for the queen, would normally mean death. But the king loved Esther. And he tells her, look, you can have whatever you want. Of course you can come into my presence. And Esther then carries out this plan that she's devised with Mordecai. And she invites just the king and Haman to two evening meals, two special dinners over two evenings. Now, the first evening, after the first meal, the king couldn't sleep. I'm not sure whether that was his wife's food or what that was. But anyway, the king couldn't sleep. And so he stays awake reading the royal diaries. And he reminds himself how Mordecai had saved his life from an attempted assassination. And he remembered how Mordecai had not actually been rewarded at that time or recognized for what he'd done. So he decides, look, I need to do something about this. And so he decides to reward and honor Mordecai. So next day, Mordecai is paraded through the streets and identified as the king's hero. And the king gets Haman, his arch enemy, to lead the parade and to be making this announcement that this is the king's hero. Haman was definitely not having a good day. But it was about to get even worse. The second evening meal came. And the Esther held this for King Xerxes and Haman. It was just the three of them together again. And Queen Esther reveals to the king that she is a Jew. And she also says, but there's more than that. I need to tell you that somebody is trying to kill me and my people. And the king is furious and says, who is this? And she points at Haman and says, this is the man who's trying to kill me. And this is the man who's trying to kill my people. And the king is furious with Haman. And he decides, look, this man's got to be punished for this. And he orders that Haman should be taken to the scaffold, which had been intended for Mordecai, and Haman was killed there instead, immediately executed for what he had attempted to do. And the king also ordered that a law be placed so that the Jews could defend themselves, that they could take revenge on their enemies who tried to attack them and to kill them at that time. And many thousands of their enemies were slaughtered by the Jewish people as they got revenge on those who were trying to destroy them. And Mordecai was rewarded by the king. He was given the position that Haman had of second in command. And the story ends in a very positive way. Haman, the enemy of the Jews, is dead, and the Jews in Persia are safe. And then we have just two final chapters in the story of Esther, chapter 9 and 10. And this concludes with instructions from Mordecai and also from Queen Esther, that this deliverance from the massacre that's taken place in this story that we've just been looking at, that this should be annually celebrated, because this was such a big thing in the history of the Jewish people. The Purim celebration. And this was to be held on the 14th day of Adar, which this year was on the 1st of March, in this year, 2018. Now, Purim means lots, as we remember how Haman, he cast lots to decide the day for which the Jews were going to be executed. Of course, it didn't happen. Instead, he ended up being executed himself. But that's why it's called the Purim Festival, as they remember this day that Haman chose for the extermination. And even during Jesus' day, and even today, the Purim Festival is celebrated very enthusiastically by the Jewish people. It's a day of joy, of fun, of happiness in the Jewish calendar. The Festival of Purim is really the story of Esther and Mordecai, and that's what we're thinking about this morning. And they have this very short fast at the beginning of the festival as they remember how Esther and Mordecai and the Jewish people, that they fasted for 3 days before Esther courageously went before the king to ask for her plan. And these are carnival-like celebrations. where the Jews, they wear masks, they have street parties, they hold beauty pageants as well, beauty contests. And then during the festival, the book of Esther is read all the way through, as I mentioned right at the beginning. It's one of the five books in the Bible that's intended to be read at the festivals. And the book of Esther is read in the synagogues. Now, it's customary that this is read through in a very sort of pantomime-style approach, okay? So you need to cheer when the heroes Esther and Mordecai are announced as you read through the story, and then you're meant to boo and hiss when Haman's name is mentioned. As a church, for some reason, we missed the opportunity to celebrate Purim in March. I'm not quite sure what was going on there, Phil, but I thought maybe we'd just get a sense of that today as we just think about the Purim festival and the story of Esther and what that's about. Now, you'll be pleased to hear, I'm not suggesting that we have a beauty contest. You're okay? We're not doing that. But I thought it'd be good just to read through a couple of verses in Esther and for us to respond in a Purim-like way as the Jews would respond during the Purim festival. So what I'd like you to do is to give a loud cheer when we read the names of Esther and Mordecai, and a loud boo and hiss when the name of Haman is mentioned, okay? I think we're going to have a practice run of this, because I can see everyone's a little bit too settled. Okay, so our heroes, Queen Esther, hooray! Mordecai, hooray! And our villain, Haman, boo, hiss. Excellent. I think we're getting warmed up. Okay, so let's have our reading from Esther chapter 8. So we're just going to read two verses, you'll be pleased to hear. No more than that. An opportunity for us to read in the style of the Purim festival. That same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther, hooray, the estate of Haman, hiss, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai, hooray, came into the presence of the king. For Esther, hooray, had told how he was related to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, boos, and presented it to Mordecai, hooray. And Esther, hooray, appointed him over Haman's estate, boos. All right, I think we're going to stop there. But you get the idea. That's what happens in the reading of the book of Esther, and that's how it's meant to be read as it's celebrated. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16 reminds us that all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness, so that the man or woman of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. And you probably can't see it, but the book of Esther's on the top shelf there on that library under the history section. So what can we learn about this story about Esther? A book in the Bible which has got no mention of God in it. A book with no direct reference to worship or prayer. It's a bit of a challenge as I came to prepare this thing. Oh, what do I actually share with you from a Christian perspective here? But I think God does have a purpose in this book, most definitely does. And there are two main lessons that I think that we can learn from this story of Esther. First of all, that God is in control. The book of Esther is very much about God's provision and God's protection. God may not have been mentioned in the book, but the presence of God and his influence is definitely within this book. God was actively guiding and supporting his people the whole time through that story. God would never let them down. He would always be there for his people. And God can sometimes appear to be hidden, but he is always there, even if we don't feel that he's nearby, or if we don't feel that we can see his actions. But God is always there. That unseen hand of God directing and steering world events towards his own purposes, showing his grace to his people, providing them with what maybe they didn't deserve, showing his mercy to them, protecting them from maybe what they did deserve. But God is sovereign. God is in control. God is ruler over all creation, over everything that he's made. And world events and history, even though sometimes we read about them in our newspapers or watch on our television screens, and it seems that so many bad things are taking place. But these things are actually all controlled ultimately by God. Nothing takes place by chance. Nothing takes place by fate or even by nature. Nothing is controlled by man's scheming or manipulation that God can't correct and move on to his own ends. God controls history, directing and overruling all of human affairs. And world history shows this. As we look back, history, his story, this is about God's story. God is in control. Shall I come back to that moment? Haman had planned to massacre the Jews, to kill them all off in Persia. That was his big idea. That was his plan. Reminiscent of Hitler, who tried very much systematically to kill the Jews during the Second World War in the 1940s. But both Haman's attempt and also Hitler's attempt to kill the Jews, they failed. Why was that? That was because God was in control. Haman's plan to exterminate the Jews, it was foiled by God's behind-the-scenes activities as he worked in the lives of Esther and Mordecai, bringing together a remarkable series of events and apparent coincidences to avoid a Jewish Holocaust. But these were no coincidences, were they? God was there in the middle of those activities, making this work towards his own purposes. God, the King of Kings, has stepped into this situation that we read about in the book of Esther. He was intervening on behalf of the Jewish people. God had not forgotten his people. He was very aware of their needs, and he had their future mapped out for them. Just a reminder of this verse back in Genesis chapter 15, where God has said to Abraham, look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. So shall your offspring be. That was the promise that God had made to Abraham, that he was going to bless this people, that he was going to make them bountiful, that they would have many offspring. Not that they would be all annihilated and disappear off the face of the planet. And that's why God will never let his people, the Jewish people, completely be eradicated in this world. It will never happen, because God will always intervene. God is in control. God had not forgotten them. And God has also not forgotten us. Maybe you're feeling pressurized this morning. Maybe you're feeling that you are facing difficult circumstances. Then just listen to this promise that God has for you. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5 and 6, where God says, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. So we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? God is in control. He will not leave us. He will not forsake us. He promises that when we are part of his people, when we are following him. He's got plans for each one of us, plans to meet with us, plans to rescue us, plans to set us free. God is in control. The other lesson that I'd like to just think about this morning that I believe very much comes out of the book of Esther is that God can use willing people. God can use willing people. Esther was this supreme heroine. She delivered her nation from disaster. She was a woman of much more than just beauty. She was a woman of charm, a woman of strength, of guile, a selfless woman who was prepared to put herself ahead of the needs of others. And God can use the most unlikely of people in his plans to fulfill his purposes. For Esther, he transformed this young girl who really didn't know what she was going to be doing in her life. And he transformed her and made her into the queen of Persia. That was the position as God positioned her for the right time. A woman who would fast, who would seek God's presence, his guidance and wisdom. A courageous woman who was willing to stand up and be counted for the sake of others. But what about us? Or maybe we hide behind the excuse that somehow that we're just not good enough, or that we don't have the necessary skills or abilities or capabilities. God should use someone else, but not me. But God's not looking for talented people. God's not even looking for perfect people. God's looking for willing people, people who are willing to follow him and to serve him and to make themselves available to him in their lives. Be people that God can use to further his purposes at the right time, at the right place. And God knows our limitations. God knows who we are. He made us. He's our creator. He gets it. He's realistic about what we can do. And God doesn't lead us up some sort of some blind alley or some cul-de-sac. There's no cul-de-sacs with God. God has already checked the way ahead for us. He knows where he's going to take us and where he wants to take us in our lives. But we have to learn to trust him, to follow him, to be available, to be willing to follow. Proverbs 3, verse 5, a verse I'm sure is familiar to many of you. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him. And then there comes his promise, and he will make your paths straight. But there's three requirements. We need to trust in the Lord. We need to trust him with all our heart. The second one is we mustn't lean on our own understanding. We need to trust and lean on his understanding. And we need to acknowledge who he is, that he is Lord. And when all of those three things are in place as we follow him in our lives, then he makes his promise that he will make your paths straight. He's going to guide us. He'll show us the way. He will help to navigate the right direction. And God, as we've just been reading about, is the God of the impossible. This is a God who delights to make seemingly impossible things possible. A God who turns hopeless situations into victory for his honor and his glory. And when we maybe face impossible situations in our lives, and they will come, when we face those obstacles, those big barriers that seem to be in the way, God will so often amaze us with his deliverance. He doesn't always. Sometimes it's his purpose that we have to endure those challenges. But sometimes God works in our lives and just remarkably removes those barriers, those obstacles, for his glory and for his honor. God is the God of the impossible, and no situation is impossible for God. I'd like to finish with something that's probably, again, very familiar to you. You may not be able to even read that, but it's the footprint illustration. And the reason why I wanted to just read this through to you is it's a reminder, an excellent reminder of how God is always there with us, even when it seems that he's absent. But he's always there with us. So let me read this through to you. One night I dreamed a dream. I was walking along the beach with my Lord, and across the dark sky flashed scenes from my life. For each scene I noticed two sets of footprints in the sand, one belonging to me and one to my Lord. And when the last scene of my life shot before me, I looked back at the footprints in the sand, and to my surprise, I noticed that many times along the path of my life, there was only one set of footprints. And I realized that this was at the lowest and saddest times of my life. And this bothered me. And I questioned the Lord about my dilemma. Lord, you told me when I decided to follow you that you would walk and talk with me all the way. But I'm aware that during the most troublesome times of my life, there's only one set of footprints. I just don't understand why, when I needed you the most, that you left me. And he whispered, my precious child, I love you and will never leave you. Never, ever during your trials and testings. When you saw only one set of footprints, it was then that I carried you. God is always there for us, particularly during those difficult times in our lives, which will come, which do come. And it's then that God carries us. But this is only for those who are Christians, for those who are trusting their lives in him, who are following him, trusting in Jesus Christ and following in his footsteps. God is in control. And God can use willing people. And God stepped into this story, into this situation that we've been reading about in the story of Esther. God had plans to rescue his people at that time, to make sure that they were safe. But God also had plans for a future rescue mission. He had plans for another leader, Jesus Christ, who would rescue God's people. In a very different way this time. This time, this leader would actually die for them, averting that death sentence that was due for his people, and taking it on board himself on the cross, achieving that freedom from death again, but this time once and for all. This was not just for a short time, as we've been reading about in Esther, but this is for eternity, once and for all, a freedom that each one of us can be a part of. Let's pray.